Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the final day of Venerable Robina's teachings this week. Just want to let you all know that we're now live on YouTube, and Venerable Robina should arrive anytime in the next few minutes. And we're a Kanapa Center. We're a FPMTC center located in Raleigh, North Carolina, and we offer on an ongoing basis quite a few of FPMT's curriculum classes, such as Discovering Buddhism and Meditation 101 and Buddhism in a Nutshell. We also host the Light of the Path retreat with Rinpoche when we're able to hold it. And the next time we expect to have it, the next time it's scheduled is the first part of September next year, a two-week retreat up in beautiful Black Mountain, North Carolina. So hope to see lots of you there. And it's really been wonderful to have people joining us from all over the world for these teachings. So we really love having you all here. I also want to take a moment and thank our the wonderful logistics team. You know, I'm kind of the face of the center here, but I couldn't do it without the help of our wonderful team, which is Linda Saw, Laura Carvalho, Susie Baum, Barb Baranski, and Chris Baranski. So yay for all of you.
This is for all of you to say thank you.
Oh, thank you, Denise.
Offer to you guys.
Morning.
Venerable Robina is here.
Hello, everybody. Happy to see you all. Okay. Let me draw a little motivation. Putting ourselves in the right direction, stating our purpose. The lamas would say motivation. We might say, what's our purpose? What's our goal? Why are we together today? Is to listen, all of us, including me, and think about and contemplate the meaning of these words to see if we can internalize them, use them as tools. Here it is, advice. That's the main thing. You don't have to take the advice, but you have to listen to it as that. You're the boss. No one's forcing you to take it, but to hear it as advice. To do what? To do two things. Help us develop our own amazing potential so that we can qualify to help others. I mean, that's all the way to Buddha. Sangye charang soke chok nam la jantro baru dagni kyab su chi dagi chani
engi patonan. Volume up, it's, we're getting audio, it's just way, way, way down.
Oh, maybe so.
You need to, okay. Sangye charang soke chok nam la jantro baru dagni kyab su chi dagi chani engi patonan ki.
So many
controls. Don't everybody. Sangye, sorry. I go for refuge in time and license to the Buddha Dharma Supreme Assembly, and by the merits I create from listening to this Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. That'll do. That's enough. Okay. Okay. So, okay. 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 What were you talking about? I think it's often that we get so confused because it's such a big fat path. When you hear the lamb ring, you think, what on earth are they talking about? Where's it all fit? What's practice? I know when I first heard my teaching from Lama Zopa Rinpoche, the first time I heard the lamb ring, my very first teaching, one whole month, I sat there because I knew there was something here that was mine. But I swear to you, I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. I heard the words, but it was just this arcane medieval presentation of this strange universe, you know, and I just didn't know what to do with it. It was just so abstract. I didn't know what to do with it. I kept saying to myself, where's the Buddhism, you know? So it takes a while. But I think once we start to realize, you see, okay, the other problem is because we're so addicted to this idea of spiritual practice, especially meditation, is something you do, you cross your legs, you cross your eyes, or you close your eyes, or whatever, and you have some mystical experience. I mean, I'm being a bit cliched, but we really have this obsessive idea about this thing called meditation. We began to talk about this yesterday. But the point is, when we understand the word, this is the point of being a Buddhist. This is the point of being a Buddhist. We understand the word, the verb in Tibetan for the verb to meditate. It's the verb, it's gom, it's the word, the verb to familiarize. So it throws us completely. Because if we do think about meditation, like we talked yesterday, we think about the first mode of meditation, which is the concentration. That's what we think of as meditation. Absolutely, across the board, throughout the world, mindfulness, that's the broad term we use, and that's what we think of as meditation. So what we described yesterday, let's just, you know, remind ourselves, the word to, is it translated as to familiarize? Then we've got to know what you mean. What are you familiarizing yourself with? And which part of you? I mean, you know, when you make a cake, you're familiarizing yourself with the recipe. When you practice music, you're familiarizing yourself with the musical theory and then the playing of the piano. So it's a fancy word for to learn how to do something, to get used to it, to practice it. So what part of us practices? In the place of music, it's got to start with your mind, and then your hands carry out the wishes of the mind. If it's cakes, you start with your mind, and then your hands carry out the wishes by putting all the bits and pieces together. When it's mathematics, you start with your mind, and then your hands write the things down. So everything starts with the mind. It's pretty obvious. Well, the same here, nothing special. We have body and speech, and then we have the mind. So Buddha's telling us, very simply, this is the bottom line. At the moment, the various things we think now about the world, about who we are, about how things exist, they're wrong. In our mind, we have layers and layers and layers of misconceptions in our mind about how things exist. That's it. From A to Z in Buddhism, that's the actual point. So practicing Buddhism, just like musical theory, just like cake recipes, you start by listening to the theories. This is the point, but we can't hear it like this. People say, oh, I don't want to listen to philosophy. I want to practice. I mean, that's like saying, I don't want to listen to any cake recipe. I want to make a cake. Well, that's schizophrenic. You can't. So we have this, the problem is this powerful misconception about the word practice or meditate. We can't hear it. We don't understand the meaning. A Buddhist, a person who chooses to be a Buddhist, let's say you're 100% Buddhist, a person who chooses is a person who chooses to buy into, put it that way, it's a very nice phrase, to buy into Buddha's way of describing the universe. That's it. That's what being a Buddhist means. A Buddhist is not a person who's mindful. A Buddhist is not a person who works slowly. A Buddhist is not a person who's a vegetarian. A Buddhist is not a person who wears, you know, has a bald head because they live in vows. There are certain aspects of a Buddhist, maybe, possibly, but they're not the essential point. The essential point of what a Buddhist is a person, you know, 100% Buddhist. You can be 1% Buddhist. It's okay. You're allowed to. You're the boss. You can do one thing that Buddha says, which is, you know, watch your breath. You can do that. But it doesn't make you a Buddhist. I mean, you know, like it's like you can be 1% cook and you can pick up a knife. A cook picks up a knife. It's not much help, is it? Got to get a bit more than that, okay? You can be mindful for sure, but, you know, as Lama Zopa says, thieves need mindfulness. So we've got to get the point. And this simple point Buddha's making is that the way we think now about everything, pretty much everything, the way things exist, we're mistaken. So he's not being rude. He's not being arrogant. He's not being fundamentalist. He's not being dogmatic. He's telling us what he has found from his own experience about how things exist. He didn't make it up. It's not revelation. He's telling us, like a good scientist, how to observe reality, and this is how it is, and he's presenting it to us. And he says, over to you, baby. And this is the point now. This is the point. And we don't get this in the West. The consequence of bringing your mind into sync with reality at every level, not just emptiness, we talked about that on Saturday, not just that, everything. Where you come from. What is your mind? How does it function? What is happiness? What is suffering? What is cause and effect? You know, what is it? You know, these things, everything. It's about the whole world. It's a worldview. It's a theory of everything. Buddhism is a coherent theory of everything. Don't believe it. Check it out. And he says this, and this is the point. This is the point. Bringing our mind into sync with reality, and reality meaning what? Cause and effect. We think our mother made us. No, he says. We think our mind is the brain. No. We think we're created by God. No. We think this, we play no role in our existence. No. We do. We think happiness is coming from objects. No. We think suffering is coming from a person being mean to us. No. So everywhere we turn, Buddhism is a presentation of his view of how things exist. So he's, and this is the point now. This is the point. Bringing your mind into sync with reality is what causes you to become a Buddha. A Buddha is a person whose mind pervades the universe, sees everything as it exists, has infinite wisdom, infinite compassion, and that's the potential of every living being. That's it. That's it. That's it. That's it. Another way of presenting that is you stop suffering and get happiness. We all want that one. Not sure if we want to, you know, the idea of being a Buddha sounds a bit weird. Want to be happy? Yep. Well, that's happiness. That's the ultimate happiness. When your mind is now finally in sync with reality and you're removed from the mind all delusions. That's the essence of being a Buddhist. So therefore, if you want to be a Buddhist, you've got to listen to what Buddha thinks. And then you decide if you'd like to take on that ball, take on board that you. Just like if you want to learn to be Einstein. You don't kick and shout and yell and, oh, I'm not going to do what Einstein says. I'm going to do what I want. Well, you won't become like Einstein if that's the case. If you choose to become like Einstein, you got to think like Einstein. If you choose to become like Bach, you got to think like Bach. If you choose to become like, you know, some famous cook, you got to think like that cook. You're not being a slave by thinking what they think. You've chosen to think it. And if you can prove they're wrong, all power to you. So Buddha presents this entire path like we're talking. The Tibetans package it, you know, the Lam Rim, as we talk about it, the Tsongkhapa, our lineage Lama, 14th century, he packages all this reality. First one is, you know, the essence of the first level is cause and effect. The law of karma is a natural law of reality. It's a natural law. He didn't make it up. He's seen it. He's observed it with his own mind. This is the point. That everything exists according to the law of cause and effect, that every sentient being that exists, every monkey, every dog, every human being, every being that isn't, we can't see the deposits existing. They're experiencing right now the fruits of their past actions, and every sentient being second is creating the causes for their future experience. It's a very intense, outrageous view. It means we are the creator of ourselves. It's powerful. So just beginning to take all this on board is already brings incredible change in our lives. It causes us not to get less depressed, less anxious, less angry, less attached, less blaming, less victim. There's no question. Because attachment, anger, blame, low self-esteem are the consequences of the philosophy we have now, which is that we're innocent victims. We didn't ask to get born. It's not our fault. That's exactly how we lead our lives. And that's exactly how we suffer, why we go crazy, why we suffer. It's not criticizing us. We should have compassion for ourselves because we're up a creek without a paddle or up a garden path, lost, Buddha says. So we listen to how karma, and then again, not knowing, doesn't, you know, you don't just believe the recipe. Oh, I believe in cooking. I believe in recipes. You have to know it, learn it, internalize it, make it your thoughts, and then you'll get the cake. So what's the product? You know, the product of playing music is you become like Bach. The product of becoming a cook is you making cakes is you become a cook. The product of learning math is you become a mathematician. What's the product of practicing Buddhism? You become a blissful person. Wow. Who doesn't want that? Happy, not suffering. Wise and capable of helping others. That's pretty nice. So the product is you. You turn yourself into the best version of yourself. A Buddha is just a best version of everybody, and Buddha says everyone can become it. We have these words, right? Because they're not our language, we mystify them. So one of the things they say in Buddhism, as we know, is we all possess Buddha nature. That's not how we talk, you know, it's a bit strange. What does that mean? Some kind of little mini Buddha in there that we've got to dig out and expose to the world? No. It means it's our potential. So I always like to use that simple example of an acorn, you know. An acorn, because it's a seed, but it's a very vivid thing. But an acorn's a very fat thing. And, you know, so really all he's saying is, and we can see the logic of this, this is scientific truth. An acorn, all acorns, we know an acorn is a seed that if you give it the right conditions, eventually will turn into an oak tree. Now, this is the interesting point. If you look at an acorn and you look at an oak tree and you've never heard of botany, you could never in a million years imagine that that little thing would turn into that big thing. It's not evident, is it? It's not evident. So all acorns possess oak tree nature. That's it. We don't talk like that. We don't say that all acorns are potential oak trees. It's a perfect statement, completely correct. We just say it's a seed. I mean, not a seed. Everything's conditions turns into an oak tree. That's what we're saying about humans. No, that's what we said about every consciousness. Every mind possessor. This lovely word in Tibetan that we translate in English as sentient being. It's much like mind possessor, sentient, a possessor of mind. Well, an ant is one of those. A dog. All the ones we see, all the tiny dust mites, they're all sentient beings. And all of fantasy in the realms of existence. God realms, spirits, hell beings, all these billions and trillions and trillions of mind possessors concerned. Every experience, every conscious possesses this potential to be a Buddha. And like we talked, Buddha implies the eradication of all these misconceptions that he does up garden paths that causes suffering and causes stress. He has found that they are not at the core of our being. This is a revolutionary psychological finding. Believe me, it does not exist in our culture. There's nothing remotely like it in neuroscience. No, I mean, we tried cutting out bits of the brain from the 1930s, but didn't we? Called them lobotomies. What good did it do? So we made a mistake in thinking that's the mind, you know? The way I like to say about the brain, not trying to insult neuroscientists because it's an amazing science, I'm not trying to insult it. But the brain, the physical brain, is the physical indicator of what's in the mind. Remember I quoted, when we talked about, I think Roucher's book about death, and I read this book while I was editing that book. I read a book by an American medical journalist called The Undead. All the problems, all the contradictions and problems in the West, in America, particularly in the different states, real confusion now, all because of the business of giving, you know, donating organs, real confusion about when death really does, when it starts, when does life end? There's real confusion now, which is brilliant because it's forcing people to question their assumptions, you know? And I mean, and so there's a whole chapter on people coming back to life. I mean, this is cultures for centuries have already reported this. We didn't know what to do with it in our scientific world. We just think it's silly. We can't answer it. And also he had a whole chapter on out-of-body experiences, people who on the operating table under anesthetic, you know, are completely conscious. Their subtle mind. They don't actually leave the body, but you have the experience as if you're floating above, but you're in the body still. It's your subtle mind. So these things, people can't argue with these experiences, you know, they can't. So one doctor in that book was quoted as saying, I can now say with certainty that consciousness is not a function of the brain. I don't know what it is, but I can say that much. That's a really powerful conclusion to come to from evidence, you know. So this is the Buddhist point. Back to, you know, more than 2,500 years, he's been telling us quietly that your consciousness is not the brain, and the consciousness is not stuck with the one you're born with. That's why neuroplasticity, we're all so excited about that. Like we found the truth, you know. The Buddha's been telling us for 2,500 years that that's true. Remember one Canadian scientist said, you know, the greatest finding of the 20th century, that you're not stuck with the brain you're born with. So it's amazing that we're proving it now in the physical world. The Buddha's been telling us that all the time. Consciousness is not your brain. Consciousness goes to much more subtle levels of cognition. Consciousness finally is pure in its nature. That's what we learn in the Mahamudra teaching, so delicious, you know. Consciousness is this capacity for cognition. It functions through our senses and functions through our mental consciousness. That's where the workshop is. And they go to incredibly subtle level. And we need to plumb the depths of our mind using these brilliant techniques coming from the Buddha, which came in turn from the Hindus, this concentration meditation technique. All these amazing skills and all these tools are all there to help us become intimately familiar with our consciousness, our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions. And then the crucial job we have to do, because we know by the end result that we have to do that, if we can get rid of all the delusions and grow all the goodness, that's the meaning of Buddha. It implies the method to learn to develop, to distinguish between the neuroses and the virtues. That's the key job of a Buddhist that gets the end result. Removing the misconceptions. So he talks a lot about the emotional misconceptions. They're the ones that really dominate us. And when we think about karma, we call that a belief. If we think about a creator, we say that's a belief. But if we think about anger, we think of it as an emotion. This is a very fascinating point. But they're both beliefs. What is, you know, if I'm, like I talk about Donna, being I'm mad at Donna. She is the cause of our suffering, I'll say. Well, that's a belief. It's very simple. It's a belief. So we're all angry. So we've all got these beliefs. We believe that the person who harms us is the cause of our suffering. We believe they're horrible. We believe cakes make us happy. We believe the delicious boyfriend makes me happy. These are beliefs. And Buddha says they've got no valid basis. It's very simple. So they happen to have an added component called emotion, which means we use our fists to punch and kill the person we think is ugly. So these are very intense. But it's all the mind. It's all the mind. It comes down to the mind. Everything comes down to the mind. The body is the servant of the mind, you know. That's why first level junior school, grade one entry level, karma level, control your body and speech. Control the servants. Then you can begin to start to control the boss, which is the mind. You know, it's pretty logical. Progression and practice. So it's really hard to know about the mind because, as His Holiness said in his commentary on Mahamudra, it's already fine to talk about all the qualities and the characteristics and listen to your anger and jealousy and hear the stories, but to actually directly experience your consciousness, it's not physical. It's very hard to do. It's pretty intense. And it's only when we get to the most subtle levels of realizations that we can do that. You know? So it's quite sophisticated. So we have to remove from our mind the misconceptions. So that means we've got to have enough courage and grown-upness to actually want to listen to what Buddha thinks. No one's here. You see, what our trouble is, we hear of spiritual philosophical views as beliefs. And so we can't prove them. That's why we feel we've got to just believe them, no choice. That's not the Buddha's view at all. That's foolish. We don't say, I believe in botany. We don't say, I believe in math. You can, you could, and you would get away with it because enough people can count that you can rely upon them. But if your mother asks you to go and buy 5 oranges, you will not be able to do that because you can't use math because you don't know it. This is the point. So we are so obsessed to and addicted to the belief that spiritual equals belief, meaning you can't prove it. That's a load of rubbish. Buddha says if something exists, by definition, an existent. One of the synonyms for that which exists, as we discussed when we talked about emptiness, there are 5 synonyms for that which exists. And this is the point. An existent, by definition, is that which can be cognized by mind. So it's automatic. You can cognize it exists. And if it exists, it is that which can be cognized. This is kind of powerful. Mind is kind of secondary for us in the external world. You know, we just think external things are the main one. No, mind is the main thing for the Buddha. So the emotional afflictions, as they call them, the mental illnesses, ego, grasping, attachment, and anger, those 3 toxic emotions, which are the summary of all the other 83,997 that Buddha presents in his marvelous, coherent model of the mind. They cover everything, you know, but some of them are these emotional ones and the other ones, it causes problems. I mean, you can argue that, you know, you believe Donna's a nice person and or ugly person, and you might not have a war over it. But we can see, oh no, sorry, that's not so cool. I don't mean that. I mean, you can have the view of believing in a creator, and you can have the view of believing that your mother made you. And so that can be quietly there without causing too much fuss. But when it's anger and attachment and all the other intensely emotional misconceptions, they're the ones that cause the problems. So they're the ones when we point here, the emotional misconceptions. And they're emotional. This is an interesting point. Like we talked to on Saturday. Kim's point. Why do we keep believing in an I if it doesn't exist? What's that? What's the benefit? Because it's habit. That's it. So why do you get angry? Because it's habit. Why are you jealous? Because it's habit. Why do you believe that your mother made you? Because that's a philosophical view. That's a habit. Why you got ignorance, ego grasping? It's a habit. That's it. It's almost too simple. It's habits, and not from mummy and daddy. Not, you don't get track back that way. And if God made you, and I don't know how they answer this in Christianity, and I'm not trying to be rude, but if God did make me, I find it very hard to know why he can't be responsible for the bad as well as the good. But that's why they say that he gives us choice, isn't it? He gives us free will, I say. But the Buddhist one is we come into this life program with our own virtuous conceptions, which are valid relatively, and the invalid misconceptions, the misconceptions. And they're all just a bunch of habits. That's why the little boy was crying with compassion for the lice at the age of 3, and that's why the other little boy wanted to kill the fish, because they each had those habits in their mind from having practiced them before. They're a bunch of habits. And that's a revelation, because when you know with a habit, you can change it. It's not set in stone. It's just powerful. That's the point the Buddha's making. So then you, being a Buddhist means you're a person who takes on board as your hypothesis until you prove it that your consciousness is not physical. It is not the handiwork of mummy and daddy. It is not the handiwork of a creator. It doesn't have a beginning and it doesn't have an end. That's the Mahayana view. it's the law that runs it, or the law within which it runs, is this law of cause and effect. Such that every millisecond of what you think and do and say, none of it goes astray. It's got a very particular character that causes whatever you think and do and say to either be labeled negative or positive, depending on all the conditions put together. Those that are negative, so seeds of the mind, that will ripen eventually in the future as your type of rebirth and your tendencies and your experiences. We are our own creator. Those actions of body, speech, and mind that are so-called virtuous, sow seeds in the mind that will ripen in the future as a type of rebirth, and our experiences, the hands of others, and the environment, and our tendencies. So we are the creators of ourselves. It's the best way to put the view of karma. This is Buddha's reality. This is what he says is reality. Now, we get nervous if someone says this is how things are, when it's called religious philosophy. When it's called mathematics, we are happy to hear Einstein tell us with certainty that 1 + 1 is 2. We're happy to hear that certainty. We don't say, who do you think you are telling me what to think? How dare you shove down that down my throat? No, we are delighted. We are delighted when we hear that he has discovered that E equals MC squared. We don't say, who do you think you are? Why? Because we know he didn't make it up. We know he's not a creator. We know he's not telling us to believe him. We know that it's not just a vision or speculation. We know that automatically. And that's the point about the Buddha. So we apply the same intelligence that we would to Einstein to the Buddha. Do it properly. Because you're the boss, finally. So you take it as your hypothesis and you work with it every day. And then slowly, slowly, like all thoughts, it becomes experiential. You've got to be patient, you know. That's what practice means. You keep thinking it until eventually you experience the truth of it. That's it. So a Buddhist is the person who abides by, who buys into and thinks about and takes as a hypothesis the view of karma, that everything you think and do and say produces who you become, and that everything you're thinking, experiencing is product of what you have done. Two, that you're not the handiwork, therefore, of mummy or daddy or creator, that your mind isn't the brain, that your mind has got these more subtle levels, that your mind has this marvelous potential, that delusions are not at the core of your being, that they're the cause of your suffering, that they're the cause of why you harm others, that virtues are the cause of your happiness and why you help others. And we can develop these to perfection and rid the mind of all the rubbish. That's it, that's being a Buddhist. If you want to, you have to decide. I'm just, you know, it's not dogma. It's not dogma. It's called scientific findings. I'm not being sarcastic. It's Einstein's findings are that E equals MC squared. Buddha's findings are these things we're describing here. And it's our decision to buy into them and live according to them. So again, what are the consequences of this? You become this blissful, amazing being with a mind that pervades the universe, that sees the minds of all others, and has infinite compassion. Because the opposite of that is how we are now, which is the fruit of delusions. The fundamental delusion of ego grasping, of ignorance, is what causes us to actually have a separate sense of self. This sounds pretty abstract. Why we even have me and other, enemy and friend, is because of this ego grasping. And when you've annihilated that by realizing emptiness, then you eventually have compassion. There's no longer a sense of a separate I. It's as if your I now is as big as the universe. As if everyone's your child. As if everyone is your beloved. As if everyone is you. There's no separation. Not possible. And you have the wisdom to see their minds perfectly. And you have the wisdom to see all their past karma perfectly. Which means you're qualified to know how to help them. That's a Buddha. It's a real person. Or some weird thing in the sky, you know. And that's our potential. Naturally. Naturally. Everyone has that potential. Every dog, every pedophile, every Hitler, every Mr. Trump. That's their true nature. So our job on the compassion wing is to help them become it. That's the job. So that's what we've been talking about, isn't it, all these days? So let's look more at the compassion wing now. Like we've been talking, you know, there's different stages of kind of like different levels of realization. So the essence of the first lot is what on the basis of understanding karma and suffering, and your own delusions, and you're sick of suffering, and you want to go beyond it. That's what they call renunciation. You're giving up suffering and its causes, which brings you to become already a marvelous person, self-contained, self-confident, less neurotic, less up and down, more brave, more courageous, more content, more fulfilled. Who doesn't want to be like that? Then we go to the compassion wing. A next level of amazing, next level of realization is what's this called bodhicitta, the combination of incredible levels of love and compassion. Incredible levels of love and compassion. And the next level, the final stages of our practice, the six perfections of this bodhisattva, is the final, is the development of wisdom. Cutting the root. Like we talked on Saturday. That's the point. That's the political wing. Help others. But it's not enough. As we've been talking the whole time. You've got to be imbued with wisdom, with clarity, with courage. So wisdom gives power and strength and intelligence to your compassion. And compassion too is not some sentimental soft thing, which is how we think about it. I mean, there is an aspect of compassion that is absolutely soft, but not weak and sentimental. Oh, the poor thing, can't help it, and pat them on the head. You do that to the panther and they'll eat you for breakfast. So don't be foolish. It's a much deeper, more profound level of compassion. But there's this interesting level of compassion that's unique to the bodhisattva path. It's called, actually called great compassion. It's like a technical term. It's a more intense level of compassion. Mahakaruna in Sanskrit. So compassion, like I said, the essence of the compassion wing of all the virtues, the essence of all the virtues is love and compassion. So they're also conceptual stories, but they're packed with emotion if we've got them strong and we can practice them. So love is the thought, may you be happy. And then you've got the next level of love. It's like the same as the next level of compassion. You don't often hear it like that, but it's like that. It's called great love. It says not only, oh, may they be happy, but then it's the sense, as His Holiness says, is the attitude of the bodhisattva, like the saints, which is what we're trying to become, is this sense of responsibility. It's my job. And the mother is a perfect example. So love is a delight in someone's happiness. And then compassion is empathy with their suffering. Oh my God, look at that suffering. That's unbearable. But the next level, which takes courage, this is the key function of the bodhisattva, this powerful sense of responsibility that demands a lot of effort and courage to say, it's my job. What can I do to fix it? That's the key difference, the key characteristic of the compassion of the bodhisattva path, which is the one that we have to cultivate. This brave attitude, as they say, of the bodhisattva. The brave attitude that it's my job. And of course, and this is the key point again about compassion. It's the wish to help, but it's wisdom that enables you to do it. You've got to have both. The bird needs two wings. It's so important to you. In other words, it's the same thing with nutrition. You might see all these unsuffering people, so unhealthy, and you have such compassion. And then you go, I must help them. So what do you have to learn? You got to learn the wisdom wing. You got to learn nutrition. Same here with the mind. We're talking about the mind here. You see people suffering and causing themselves suffering. And you have compassion. So how are you going to help them? You have to know what suffering is and compassion and all the methods. That's the wisdom wing. You can't just leap in and cross your fingers and hope for the best. So this attitude of it's my job, that takes courage. Gradually, one step. You only do one step at a time. You know, if you get to the level of being like his, like Lama Zab Rinpoche, who doesn't sleep day and night, for whom sleep is a disgusting waste of time, but he's so motivated by compassion, the unbearable suffering of all the beings, it's almost hard to believe there can be such levels of compassion. That level of compassion can only come from removing the delusion, which is the wisdom wing. When there's no longer attachment, there's no longer anger, and there's no longer a sense of a separate I, your compassion is limitless. Unbelievable, real, to have that level of enthusiasm is hard to even imagine, you know. So we do what we can. We have to grow it. It takes effort. Everything takes effort. Everything you can't do that you decide to learn naturally takes effort. We shouldn't be scared of that. So this, you're not going to be talking, I think, but we'll say it again, we'll discuss it again. The very first, you know, there's different presentations in the teachings, techniques that have been passed down over the centuries, little packages of techniques for practicing, for culminating, for developing this outrageous view of bodhicitta, which is the culmination of love, compassion, great compassion, eventually this attitude, this aspiration, this shift in the mind, where now others are more important than you. That essentially is the characteristic of a person with bodhicitta, this amazing attitude, as a result of all this hard work that culminates in that. And that's outrageous. And in our world, in our psychology, that's like a mentally ill person. We just can't posit that kind of thought in our culture. That's just too bizarre. We have no anything equivalent to that in modern psychology. The only equivalent is like a Christian saint or any some kind of saint. And that's just something up in the sky special. You don't go to some psychology course to learn how to be a saint, do you? But that's exactly the Buddhist approach to being a bodhisattva. Because Buddha says it's psychology and we're capable of it. And in fact, that's our natural. But until we get to that point, we've still got delusions in the mind, which means... So here you have to hear it carefully. We love talks about it. We love it. It's inspiring to read all the great yogis' biographies. You know, it's inspiring to read about the great meditators who have accomplished this. It's very moving to think this, you know, and to know, wow, they can do it, I can do it too. And all the Tibetans, as we know, love to read about Mirareka, you know. This 11th century great yogi, who was some kind of wacko, crazy guy earlier, and then he sort of, you know, found the path and disappeared into the mountains and became a Buddha. It's very inspiring to read the yogi stories. Let me just read you. I want to read you, okay? It's very moving. There's years and years and years ago. No, okay, sorry, jumping. Has Geshe Lama Kwantok, Robbie, are you there? Is Robbie there this morning? Robert? No. Can't see him. Doesn't seem like he's there. Okay. Does anybody know if Geshe Lama Kwantok ever came to North Carolina? Did anybody know that?
Who?
Geshe Lama Kwantok. Did he ever come, Robbie? You mean Geshe Lama Kwantok, the yogi, you know, the one who spent up years in the mountains.
I have problems with my
neck. I'm sorry. He never came to North Carolina? He never came to Raleigh? It would have been before 2001. He died in 2001. No?
No.
Okay. Never mind. I thought he might have. So he says, I'll tell you about him. I want to tell you about him. It's just somehow very moving to hear stories. You know, I find anyway, very inspiring. So he was this monk in Tibet. Yes, they at Sarah J. Monastic University in Lhasa. He was born in 1927 and Lama Geshe was born in 1935. And so when they escaped, so they both became monks when they were about 5 or 6, so they were a few years apart, but they knew each other. And this Geshe Lama Kwantok, I was writing his biography, his attendant asked me to do it, and then it was in his voice, and I was putting it together, but somehow we stopped 10 years ago, I don't know why, but it's amazingly moving. I want to read you a little bit from it. It's very inspiring, these great yogis, you know. So he was an amazing scholar, but very independent. Since he's a very tiny boy, he knew he was on the case, you know. He'd been already sort of unofficially was recognized as a reincarnated yogi from his past life. So he's very brilliant, but he just disappears sometimes, go off and live with this particular group of nuns and learn all these wonderful tunes. You go over there and learn about all these amazing, the Tibetan medical system, which herbs for this with thing. He was a scholar and a great yogi, and he had his hand in everything. He was very knowledgeable about medicine, about rituals, about the emptiness, everything. It was amazing, amazing. And he was really sincere and very intense. And then eventually, when they all escaped in 59, he went off on his, he was very independent. These yogis are like that. They don't follow the crowd, you know. So he spoke very, so he said he had a dream in which Milarepa told him the direction to go to escape the country. So he escaped on his own over the mountains in 59. And then he got to this, then he went to this little village in Nepal, right on the border of Tibet, way up at the top corner of Nepal, you know, right on the border of Tibet. And that's the area where Milarepa in the 11th century and many great yogis used to meditate for years and years in caves. There's a whole area called the Cave of the Doves. And so he spent first 6 years in one of these caves, and he got to the point. Okay, sorry. He went up that part of Tibet first, to Nepal, to those caves, and then he came down to Kathmandu, and then he met his gurus who had already escaped from Tibet. He met his friends from. He went to Bodh Gaya. He got these initiations from His Holiness Dalai Lama in the early 60s. All these things, and then his own teacher, who actually was Trijang Rinpoche, the one of the gurus of His Holiness. Oh. Sorry. Sorry, my trains are playing. I can't stop them. Sorry. So, yeah, okay. So then his own guru said, you just go up to the mountains and go. So he literally got on a bus and he just kept walking with nothing, no possessions, nothing. So all those years in the monastery, remember this, the way they train, they learn and they learn everything and they learn it. They're like walking computers. They have all the texts, all the practices, everything in their mind. They don't need anything. This is quite amazing. I know Lama Sopa would often be sad about us in the West. We just don't use our memories. Because if you have the view of reincarnation, you know, you've got to have something really strong in your mind if you want to have it for the next life. If you really practice it powerfully and well, good or bad, you'll remember it next life. That's why we come into this life programmed. So we don't, you know, so they memorize everything. They're like little computers. So they don't have texts. They don't write things down. They memorize everything. Well, they have texts. So he disappeared over there and then he came down to Kathmandu with his little, and he left up there in the mountains. He left in one family his little bag of texts. That's it. And then one day when it was back in Kathmandu and his teacher said, you've got to go off to meditate. Time to meditate. He'd done all his years of practice, all his years of listening, all his years of debating, all his years of internalizing all the knowledge. He now had to get to the point of internalizing it, experiencing the truth of it, literally familiarizing his mind with it in deep, subtle meditation. That's where you finally, where the penny drops. So he disappeared. He just got off the bus and he kept walking. There's a little story about these nuns who were going up that area too. And he kept walking. That's it. Singing these lovely songs to the Dakinis, to the angels, you know. So then he disappeared. No one heard of him for years. And he went up to this particular cave, which is Milarepa's cave, and he spent probably 6.5 years in this first one. Very soon, becoming familiar with not eating, he liked Milarepa, he started to live on nettles, and then eventually he didn't need any food at all. There's a pill the Tibetan doctors make called Chulen. And they get the essence from all the minerals and everything, and the yogis can live on these for years. You get very skinny, but you get enough nourishment. But he didn't even need that. He eventually was able to take the nourishment from the air. So he lived in meditation day and night. So it's obvious if you want to achieve something, if you want to become like Federer, the best way to become like Federer is to do it 12, 15 hours a day and have a good sleep and do it again. You'll achieve the goal. But I mean, these dudes do it 24 hours a day. They get to the point where they do not need sleep, do not need food. I mean, that's fanatic. We think they're mad. No, they're just going to be galvanized by intense, unbelievable compassion. The suffering of beings is so unbearable, they have to become a Buddha as quickly as possible. Well, the compassion, that's the bodhicitta one. So there he is up in his cave day and night, gets to the point he doesn't need sleep, doesn't need food. So he's got his single point of concentration. He's a total practitioner of one of the tantric deities called Vajrayogini. We haven't even discussed Tantra, but there's different asanas you do. So he was the manifestation of Vajrayogini, this radiant, blissful female Buddha. Lama Zobi said he lived in Vajrayogini Pure Land, you know. So he's practiced for 6 or 7 years, and then I'll read the story here. It explains to you. He's full on doing this job. He's done all the background. He's learned all the philosophy. He's learned to memorize it all. Now he's internalizing it. Now he's doing the actual meditating, the actual internalizing at a subtle level with his powerful, subtle mind, uninterrupted, quickly as possible, becoming this enlightened being. I'll read from his biography. Very moving, I find. As I said, it's by Tenzin Zopa, his attendant, and I'm a ghost, I'm the ghostwriter. Am I the ghostwriter or is Tenzin Zopa the ghostwriter? I'm the ghostwriter, I think. Okay. Now I have to find it though. I'm sorry, I'm not ready. It's called The Biography of a Secret Yogi. It's just, he told me to stop doing it about 12, 13 years ago. So we have to finish it, I think. Here it is. Biography of the Secret Yogi, Geshe Lama Khonsu. Okay, I'll read you a couple of chapters. The prologue. The Tenzin Zopa, who was, since a tiny boy, has been close to Geshe Lama Khonsu and became his attendant. And now he might have come there. Has he been there, Robbie? Geshe Tenzin Zopa, the young Geshe. Robert? Robbie can't hear me. What's his problem with his audio? Never mind, I can't help it. So the prologue, okay? Robbie, I want you to hear the story. Can't you hear me, Robbie?
My internet is coming and going. I can hear you.
I'm so sorry. Okay, so this is Tenzin Zopa talking. He's the I in this. If there's any I that comes in. He's not coming in yet, but he's telling the story. So in the afternoon of an early spring day in 1965, the yak herder Pasung was climbing the mountains above his village, Bushi, not far from the border of Tibet in northwest Nepal. Pasung was looking for his yaks, which he had sent out to pasture that morning. The mountains facing the north were extremely dry with very little grass. Following their tracks, he could see that they had gone further up than usual. He'd never been this far before. It was very rugged countryside and not easy to get to. Normally, yaks are quite haphazard in their eating habits. Left alone, they graze here and there, gradually moving on and up. They can go for miles in a day, eating their way into very dangerous situations. Many animals fall over the cliffs. Pasung crossed the waterfall and could see them, a few hundred yards away, grazing up the mountainside. He needed to find the lead yak so that he could herd them down. There were 10 of them. "Sho, sho, come, come," he shouted. Suddenly, he noticed, just above the yaks, a person. He wasn't even sure that it was a person, sitting in a hole in the rock face. He squinted his eyes and took a careful look to make sure he wasn't imagining things. He didn't know what to think. The person seemed huge and his hair was matted and long. He was wearing virtually nothing, just a piece of red cloth below his waist. There were caves up there, and one of them, the Cave of the Doves, is famous for being the home 900 years earlier of the great Milarepa. But no one ever lived there now, not these days, Pasung thought to himself. Who knew who this was? He wondered if it was a yeti. In the mountains, there's a strong belief in the existence of these mythical beings, said to be a bit like gorillas. Or it could even be a demon. I mean, if it's a man, he must be crazy. What's he doing up there on his own in the middle of nowhere? Pasung was alone, and it was getting dark. The clouds were moving quickly across the sky covering the top of the mountains. He was scared. He gathered his axe and got out of there. Back at Bush, the villagers decided they had to get rid of this intruder. Whoever he was, they didn't feel good about him. They were genuinely fearful that he would bring harm to the village. Lesse Pasung led two of his friends up the mountain to check out this apparition, armed with their slingshots. "Up there, you see him," he said. They shot several rocks at him, hoping to scare him away. The next thing they know is this person carrying a small pack on his back, rushing out of the cave and almost flying up the mountain, hardly touching the ground as he went. They couldn't believe their eyes, but they were relieved. Now he was gone. 2 years later, a four-hour walk west of the Cave of the Doves, the old monk Rinchen Wangchuk was returning to his tiny house in Gunden Mountain, where he lived in meditation. He'd made the house from rocks years ago and spent the winters there, coming down from Mugompa, his monastery, 8 hours further up the mountain on the route to Tibet. Now that he was old, he wanted to spend all his time in his little hut, in solitary retreat. He could have found a suitable place near his monastery. It's on one of the highest peaks and is one of the most isolated places in the region. But he knew Gunden Mountain was blessed by the energy of Vajrayogini and Hayagriva, and always the best place to meditate is a place that's been blessed by the presence of the holy beings. And of course the great Milarepa had laid his holy feet on these mountains hundreds of years before. He had a close relationship with the people of Chokhangpa, one of the nearby villages where he was born. From his hut he could see his relatives he could visit his relatives for roasted barley flour, for tsampa, and other supplies, and of course to perform prayers for them. He was happy in his retreat place, isolated from the village and in sight of no one. But in the spring of 1967, he found that he had a neighbor. It was late afternoon. He was returning from the village with supplies, but for some reason he took a different route, one he had never used before. About 10 minutes from his hut, when he glanced over, to the northeast, he noticed something moving among the rocks higher up. There seemed to be a person outside what looked like a cave. The mist was already falling, so it wasn't clear. For 2 years, there had been rumors circulating around the village about a mysterious person, a madman perhaps, even a yeti, who had been chased away from the Cave of the Doves by the villagers of Bushi. He was a bit anxious at first. He wasn't sure whether it was a person or indeed whether the fears of the villagers were based in reality. When you're in retreat, you want to be isolated, and he didn't know what to think about this new presence. Back at his hut, he couldn't get the stranger out of his mind. The very next morning, after his pre-dawn meditation session, he did some more investigation. He went to the spot from where he had seen the movement. He watched until the sun not only touched the cave, but was shining on the village in the valley. But this time he didn't see any sign of life at all, nothing. He was reluctant to go there. It could be a Yeti after all. Although irrational, he wasn't sure. By now he was really curious. His mind was full of it all day. He couldn't even meditate well. Again, next morning, he went to look. Again, nothing. This time he decided he'd go to the cave itself and find out. He made his way stealthily through the bushes, a 10-minute trek through the brush and up the mountain. He was to the left of the cave, but because of the rocks in his path, he couldn't see inside. He crept closer, but still kept to the side, throwing a stone onto the rocky outcrop that formed the roof. Four times he threw stones, but nothing happened. Then he crept around to the front of the cave and he looked inside the doorway, a hole in the rock face. There was a man, almost naked, sitting unmoving in meditation. He seemed so powerful, huge, strong. Rinchen Wangchuck was amazed by his presence. Even though his hair was down his back and in wild looking, he could see that the meditator was a monk. He was wearing just a piece of his maroon robes covering his secret parts, with the rest of his body naked. His palms weren't in his lap in the usual meditation mudra, but open, each hand resting upwards on each knee, his thumbs curled inwards, resting in the palm. He had long, straggly whiskers hanging down either side of his mouth, but almost no hair on his upper lip or on his chin. His face was very rough, dark and weather-beaten. The cave was bare, nothing at all. Just this meditator sitting on worn animal skin on the hard, rocky ground. Rinchen Wangchuck couldn't imagine how he could survive like this. And who was he? He decided this must be the person the bushy villagers thought was a Yeti, the person they'd chased away. He stood at the open doorway for a long time, just watching this amazing man meditate. But his mind was full of so many conflicting thoughts. Maybe he was crazy. How could someone live like this? He, of course, knew all the stories about Milarepa, one of the most beloved and successful meditators of Tibetan history. Everyone knew them, how he'd left the world and gone to the mountains. I'll keep hitting the key and then go to the 100th page instead of the next. And gone to the mountains, moving from cave to cave, naked, living on nettles, and eventually gaining the supreme goal of enlightenment. His songs are known and loved by all Tibetans and their Nepalese Buddhist neighbors. Reading about this is one thing, but to see someone looking just like Milarepa would have looked, living in a bare cave for who knows how long, was something else. It was hard to believe. It seemed impossible. It was certainly the first time that Rinchen Wangchuck had witnessed such a yogi. Of course, he had received initiations himself into the highest practices during his time in Tibet, but seeing someone actually embodying the practice in such a radical way, that was not within his experience. He was also beginning to feel a little embarrassed. I mean, if this man really was a great meditator, how rude to disturb him like this, throwing stones. He decided to return to his hut. But the image of this yogi overwhelmed him during his own meditation sessions. He couldn't think of anything else. He began to feel very good about him, very safe somehow. He was drawn to him and wanted to get his own sessions finished quickly so that he could get back to the cave. On the fourth day, after his mid-morning session, he went back. Again, there was the yogi in meditation. Nothing had changed since yesterday. He was absolutely still, unmoving, like a rock. Rinchen Wangchuck couldn't contain himself. He was compelled to talk to him. From the doorway, he quietly said, "May I know who you are? May I offer you some food?" There was no reply, no acknowledgement, nothing. The meditator remained in samadhi. Rinchen Wangchuck was becoming convinced that here was a genuine practitioner and he was yearning to connect with him. He longed to receive teachings from this holy being. Again, he asked his question, and again nothing. He watched him for a long time, then left. He cooked his lunch, did his afternoon session, thinking about the yogi who filled his mind. He returned to the cave. Now he sat on the ground, just in front of the door of the cave, with the afternoon sun at his back. He was but a few feet from the meditator, who was sitting facing the doorway. His heart reached out to him. There was no sign of any food. He said very quietly, "You must eat food. I have food. May I offer you some?" No response. Clearly, his efforts were getting him nowhere. Perhaps he was pushing too hard. Perhaps he'd better just leave him alone. But he couldn't let go of it. He had to meet this great yogi and receive his teachings. To receive personal instructions from someone who had direct experience of the practices was a rare and precious thing. He yearned for realizations himself and could not bear to turn away from this unbelievable opportunity. After a restless night, he returned to the cave as soon as he had finished his pre-dawn meditation. But this time he brought an offering, something auspicious, his small wooden bowl piled high with barley grain and a lump of salt. The grains for growth, expansion, and the salt when offered to a lama for the wealth of Dharma. The meditator was there as usual, naked, in samadhi. Rinzai Wangchuck knelt in front of him. Holding his gift high, he extended it towards him. "May this offering create a spiritual relationship between us. May I know who you are. Where are you from?" The yogi opened his eyes and spoke. "I am nobody. Leave me alone." His gaze was almost unbearable, powerful, piercing, steady. His voice was soft, but his words were firm. Rinzai Wangchuck's heart was beating fast. He implored him, "I'm requesting sincerely that you teach me the Dharma." "It's not possible," the yogi replied. But nothing could stop Rinzai Wangchuck now. "Whatever you demand of me, I am ready to follow. I will do exactly as you instruct." The yogi hadn't moved, his palms still resting upwards on his knees, his legs in full lotus position. After a long silence, he said, "What you're wanting is harder than you can imagine. But I'm ready, I promise. Please teach me. I have stayed at Mugompa for 40 years and I have studied in Tibet. Now I yearn to practice seriously and gain realizations. I'm trying my best to stay in solitary retreat, but I feel that I lack the blessings of the realized gurus. I am convinced you must be a great yogi. I beg you to give me teachings." The yogi kept his gaze on the old monk bent low before him. "If you follow me, you must stay in retreat for the rest of your life. If you can do that, I will give you initiations and the commentaries and guide you in your meditations." Rinzai Wangchuck was ecstatic, unbelievable, like a finding a treasure. He had found a lama, a true knowledge holder. At last he could achieve the purpose of his life, the realizations of the truth, just like all the holy beings of the past, right back to Lord Buddha himself. "But this must not go beyond us," the yogi said. "I have vowed to spend the rest of my life in solitary retreat, isolated from everyone. No one must know. And I promise I will do exactly as you say," Rinzai Wangchuck said. So now the book then starts to talk, Tenzin Zopa's voice, when he was a little boy and how he met him. And then there's another chapter when once he'd become... So what happened was a couple of years, he was quiet, and then eventually they start to meet him, the villagers, and he became like their main lama. And this is when, so Tenzin Zopa is his attendant, and he's telling the story. And he has known him since he's a tiny child, and then he went to Koppan, and he was with him. But before he went down to Koppan, he met his family. You know, he knew his family. And this is a story of how his aunt, he's one of six children, Tenzin Zopa, and he's got many aunties, and two of them are nuns. So this is a story about when the villagers first met. After that 2 years, how they first, some of the villagers first met Geshe Lama Khonchob. Geshe Lama. Okay. That was the prologue. This is now chapter 2, the difference between earth and sky. The place for the men of our region, this is Tenzin Zopa talking, the place for the men of our region. Okay, there's a monastery. I'll keep it short. There's a monastery, many monks there, and there's a nunnery, many nuns there. And he's describing the background of the forest, all this. So my great-uncle, Rinzai Wangchuck, was one of the monks. That's the meditator. When he was 60, he, in keeping with tradition, he was given permission to go off on his own into retreat. He had already built his meditation hut where he used to go for the winter in Gundan Mountain. In 1966, he decided to stay there full-time, which is when he met... Tenzin Zopa calls Geshe Lama Meme Lama, like Grandfather Lama. He always thought it was his grandpa. He met him when he was a tiny baby. Actually, Tenzin Zopa met him when he was in the... I said, "When did you first meet Geshe Lama?" This is Tenzin Zopa, the author. He said, "Oh, when I was in the womb." So the first story in chapter 1 He said he was, his mother was trying to give birth to him. He's the oldest of the six children and he wasn't coming out properly. And he said that his auntie came, his two aunties were there, the two nuns, and then Geshe-la Khonchok turned up from his cave up in the mountains and he came down and he told one of the aunties to go get some butter. So the auntie got butter and he put it in his hand and he blessed the butter, blew mantras on it, and then he gave it to the mother and said, eat the butter. So Chenzo said, what happened then was my mother ate the butter, it went down, then apparently I turned around in my mother's womb and I came out and the butter was on my crown. That's the story, okay? So you, whatever, who knows? So then anyway, Rinchen Wash, my uncle, this is where he met Meme Lama. So as is the tradition in Tibet, every family would offer at least one of their sons or daughters to the monasteries. So Auntie Chodron, Chenzo Zopa's auntie, became a nun when she was nine. First she lived at Runchit, at the nunnery with all the nuns, and then eventually when her mother died, Auntie Chodron was 13, she was forced to go back home to work for the family. I was stuck for another 12 years, she said. She was a nun. So now, Meme Lama meets the villagers. Auntie Chodron vividly recalls the event that led to her freedom. It was the late summer of 1968 and she was 23. She's telling the story. Rinchen Wangchuk had invited the six of the monks and six of us nuns, or four of us nuns, to all meet together. And they were all sitting around the prayer room one evening after puja. And then Rinchen Wangchuk said that he had something important to say. The reason I asked you to gather here today is to announce that I have met a highly realized yogi up near Ganden Gompa. I've been receiving teachings from him for a couple of years now. He said that in the beginning he had observed him really closely and eventually gained in faith in this yogi. He is truly realized, truly qualified. I tell you, you have never met such a highly realized being in all our lives. He is incredible. We were so excited, Auntie Chodron said. I felt so honored to think that a holy being would be in living so close to us. Rinchen Wangchuk told them that this yogi was Tibetan. He'd studied at Sera, one of the three great monastic universities in Lhasa. Then after his escape in 1959, came to the Cave of the Doves and meditated in isolation. And he lived there without clothes, without food, without sleep. Can you believe it? Just like Milarepa. Chodron and the others were so amazed. They knew about Milarepa, but to hear about a person living like that in their own time was hard to imagine. It seems he's the so-called Yeti we all heard about. He is the one that the Bushi villagers threw out. He'd been there for nearly 6 years. He said that he moved to some juniper trees after that, and he stayed there for another year. So when he had to escape, when they chucked rocks at him in the beginning, he rushed off. All he wanted was to find another place to carry on meditating. So he found these juniper trees, and he went underneath the branches and was 18 months or a year. He went a 6 foot of snow in the winter because he's able to completely control the heat of his own body. He lived under these juniper bushes, no food, no sleep, no clothes. I mean, these yogis, kind of intense. He's been to so many holy places. India and Tibet, yet he came here to a cave near our village on the instructions of his guru, Trijang Rinpoche, the junior tutor of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. We are so blessed. Rinchen Wangchuk told them that he himself had received many, many teachings and initiations from this yogi and that he had a profound effect on his practice. He has given me the Vajrayogini initiation and an extensive commentary on the practice over several months. All his teachings are experiential. Just hearing his words, your heart is moved. He is such a holy being. He made me vow to tell nobody, but I feel you must meet him. You must receive teachings and initiations from him. I chose all of you. You are the right people. You are ready for him. Auntie Chodron was deeply moved by Rinchen Wangchuk's words, and she felt so honored. She could not believe her good fortune. She had been sincerely practicing since she was a young girl, but she had sacrificed her life as a nun to her family, and now this amazing opportunity. But you must keep silent about this. If you feel you are ready, we can go to see him tomorrow, and I will confess to him that I revealed his secret. They were so excited. How fortunate we are. Such good karma we must have. Even though our village is so remote, with few lamas, this yogi has come here. Thank you, Rinchen Wangchuk. We are so honored. They all agreed they wanted to go to see the Lama the very next day. There was no time to waste. Good, said Rinchen Wangchuk. Each of you can bring a handful of offerings, whatever you want to give, to create auspiciousness. Next morning, Chodron and the others woke up well before dawn. Most of the group had stayed over at the house, all squeezed into the prayer room. Rinchen Wangchuk instructed everyone to make very rich butter tea and to carry it in their flasks to offer to the yogi. Chodron also brought some butter, and she carefully wrapped the special porcelain cup used for lamas. Some brought salt, Others brought grain, and one had a woolen carpet, and they all had offering scarves. They walked up the mountain together, the 11 of them, Rinchen Wangchuk and Pasang Tsering leading the way. They were silent but excited, full of anticipation. They arrived exactly as the sun was reaching the cave, which was their plan. They felt this was very auspicious. The yogi must have known they were coming. When they arrived, he was standing in front of the cave, waiting. I was so nervous, I was shaking, Chodron remembers, and I was shocked at what I saw. He was huge, far bigger than any of us. His clothes were filthy, black almost, and they were rags. I could tell they were monk's robes, but it was just bits and pieces of robe. He wasn't wearing a donka, the shirt, just a bit of cloth wrapped around his shoulders. His hair was down his back, thick and matted, sticking out wildly. His face was very wrinkled and rough. And he's living naked for 6.5, 7, 8 years in the elements, right? He stood there, his presence so powerful, saying nothing. All the lamas I had met before seemed clean and poised. They would smile nicely to greet you and say sweet words. But this man just stood there, fierce, staring at us. I didn't know what to think. But he had captured her, she said. I knew I couldn't escape from this person. He had me. But I honestly did not know whether I could cope with this. Rinchen Wangchuk introduced them. They are from Mugompa and Rachen Gompa. They would like to request initiation and teachings from you, great yogi, especially Vajrayogini. I decided I had to tell them about you. They all want the teachings so badly. They are ready. They are sincere. We're all bent low, looking down, too scared to meet his face, Chodron said. Then the yogi turned his eyes to us and spoke. Since you have a monastery, why'd you come here? He was so blunt, so direct. None of us said anything. Luckily, Rinchen Wangchuk spoke for us. They sincerely want to follow you exactly as I have done, and they have promised that the word will not get out. He stood there, silent. It seemed for ages, Chodron said. Then he spoke, strongly, clearly. If you dedicate your entire life to practice without breaking your commitments for even one day, I will accept your practice. I will accept your request. My heart was beating fast. I was so happy. Auntie Chodron said. Have you all received the highest yoga tantra initiation? If you haven't, I can't give you Vajrayogini, he said. Yes, Rinchen Wangchuk said, they have all received initiations. They are all qualified. The yogi invited them to sit down. They prostrated 3 times, each making their offering, and then sat down on the ground, squashed tight together in the small space in front of the cave. I unwrapped the porcelain cup, Chodron said, and held it out for each person to pour some tea into it from their flasks. Then I offered it to the yogi. He led the blessing, chanting the nectar offering prayer to Vajrayogini. He sat there, serious, drinking his tea, but very sweet, humble, and very relaxed. Chodron said, by now we had relaxed a bit too. Rinchen Wangchuk requested the yogi to allow everyone to take a taste of his tea for a blessing. He allowed them. Anyway, we have created a very auspicious connection. We dedicate this for liberation in this one lifetime, he said. They drank their hot butter tea in silence. Now you can go, the yogi said. I will let Rinchen Wangchuk know when the initiation will be. One of the nuns, Yang Don, was especially delighted. She knew the yogi. She didn't say a word at the cave, but she told the others later. He had come to her family's house years ago when she was a young girl. It must have been the middle of 1959, the year the Tibetans had escaped from their country. Of course, he looked very different then, but he was unmistakable. I was carrying water back from Lungbu, and I noticed this big monk walking towards my house. He came to the front door and he called out, "Hey, anyone there?" My mother invited him in and offered him roasted barley flour. He asked her if he could keep his things at her house. I only have a few texts, nothing for you to worry about, he told her. There was a fatherly feeling about him. I thought how nice it would be to have him stay with us. I could just spend time with him, but he left. My mother really took care of that bag of his, which she kept in our prayer room. A couple of months later, she said, she was again returning from Lungbu with water when some kids called out to her, "There's a big Tibetan monk in your house." I knew it was him and I was so happy. I ran all the way back home. "Amma, Amma, is it the big Tibetan monk?" "Yes," but he took his things and he's left. I had such a feeling of loss. I ran in the direction that I'd seen him coming from earlier to try to find him. I looked towards the route to Tibet, but I couldn't see him. He'd gone. They started their retreat a week later, on the 25th of the 11th Tibetan month, a special Vajrayogini day. Rinchen Wangchuk and Pasang Tsering had brought the various ritual implements and prepared the cave. The yogi looked just the same. He sat on a throne made of grass piled a foot high. The rest of them sat on scattered grass to soften the hardness of the rock. He said to them, "I've done the self-initiation, so now we can begin." The initiation took 3 days. They all stayed in the nomad huts, a 15-minute walk away. First, he recited the preliminary practices, stopping and giving instructions each step of the way. "The moment he started to teach, his words hit our hearts," Chodron said. "I was in tears. I had received Vajrayogini from other lamas, but the difference was like earth and sky." He gave the commentary on the practice every day until the 10th of the 12th month, 15 days later. We had 2 sessions of commentary every day, the first just after sunrise for 3 hours, and then after lunch, another session, another 3 hours. Sometimes they would sit around the cave together doing the practice. The yogi had to do his usual 4 sessions of meditation every day, as well as teach us. He seemed to be doing many different practices together. I could tell that he, from the recitations, that he was doing the Nyungne fasting retreat as well. They also could hear that he would be reciting all the major practices, Guhya Samaja, Yamantaka, Haruka Chakra Samvara, as well as Vajrayogini. We could hear his powerful and beautiful chanting, and if he noticed our presence, he would chant quietly. He was so humble. "This was the most special time of my life," Chodron said. "The 11 of us, whenever we would see each other in the coming years, the first words out of our mouth were always to recall those incredible 2 weeks with our precious Lama. Without doubt, for every one of us, it was the most memorable, most meaningful, the happiest days of our lives. They all felt unbelievably proud and privileged, so special. Until the end of their lives, they always expressed this." The monks, when they passed away, Chodron said, they all died with very auspicious signs. They all kept their practice purely. They completed their great retreat for 3 years. They lived a life strictly following the Lama's advice. They died with confidence in their practice. Everyone in the village praised them. "For all of them," she said, "he became their main guru, their heart Lama, just naturally. You couldn't compare him with anyone else. His way of teaching was unbelievable." When I was interviewing Tenzin Zopa and other people for this story, and the nun, she was, because he was at Kopan, and this is the time when the reincarnation of Geshe Lama Khontra was about 2 or 3, he'd been recognized and he was living in Kopan, and I would be at Kopan, and interviewing Tenzin Zopa, and the old auntie Chodron was there, she was taking care. So there she is, this little old fat lady, little Nepalese peasant, you know, in her robes, and she's a woman, so they don't pay much attention to women, I'm sorry, that, you know, these men. So I remember, I said to Tenzin Zopa, "Should I interview Auntie Chodron?" He said, "Oh no, she doesn't know anything." "Well, excuse me, that's her story. It's the most powerful story in the entire book, I promise you. I'll never forget as long as I live." But this is the humility of these people. She's done her 3-year retreat. She went into the cave after he left, came to Kopan. She did her retreat. But because they don't talk about their experiences, she never told a single human being those experiences because no one asked her. So when I said to Tenzin Zopa, "Can I interview her?" "No, she doesn't know anything." Well, look, unbelievable. That's the humility of these practitioners, you know. I was very moved by that. Honestly, that's the story I remember in the whole book, most powerful. Anyway. 2:15 for you. What time did we start? 1 o'clock, wasn't it? I think let's have a break now, okay? It's a nice spot to quietly eat the meaning of this, taste it, make our aspirations to never give up practicing, make our aspirations to meet our own special spiritual teacher, whom we can become like. Because our hearts need moving. This is the this is the power of a teacher, okay? Such as some, you know, we've got human hearts. As Lama Yeshe says, we're all dying for love. We've got a human heart. So we need to open our heart. And that's what devotion is. But don't dump your devotion on any idiot. As Pavanka Rinpoche says, choose your guru very carefully because you're going to end up like them. So once you have done your market research, have checked your teachers, and then you commit, then your heart opens. And that's the channel through which you receive the blessings to get the teachings. It's very logical, you know. Devotion is a very powerful kind of juice that enables you to get realizations, that enables you to listen to the teachings and make it real experience for you. It's the presence of that person in front of you, knowledge holder, Rigsin, knowledge holder. It's very logical. So we have a break. Half an hour. See you soon.
Venerable, before you go, there's a lot of enthusiasm and excitement about what you've just been reading and interest in the book. Is it ever going to be published? Or
I started writing it in 1995, and then I did a lot of research and put some, you know, and did it. And then 1997, Chances Over wrote to me and just said, stop doing it. And I didn't ask him why. So it's 97. So what's that, 20 years ago, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, 2007, 10 years ago, sorry, 12 years ago, 13 years ago. So I mentioned to him recently, I saw him, we've got to publish it. And he said yes. So I've got to finish it. The two-thirds of the book is done, but I haven't finished the book. So I think I must finish it. I'll make an aspiration to finish it. I mean, we've got it all up to when he, about 19, when he got to Koh Phan, but then the period when he traveled around, from 2000, I think, from 90s until 2000, when he started to travel around the world teaching, and then he died in 2001. That part isn't covered yet. But all the first part of his life is all covered. So I will, I agree. Every time I read it, I think I have to publish. We've got to publish it, you know. But I must say, I sent it off to one publisher, and they didn't like it. They said it was too childish. I have to tell you that. It's a bit embarrassing. It's shocking, isn't it? It's so moving. I agree with you. So I'll look into it. So thank you.
Okay.
We'll see you in half an hour. Thank
all you. Right.